Hey, what's up, everybody? Today's guest is player development coach of Bamberg, Stefan Weissenböck. Stefan comes from Austria and he's a longtime player development coach. He also worked for the Brooklyn Nets. And today we talked a lot about player development, in particular, specifics about communication with players, gaining their trust, how to get out of the slump, and lots of details that are nuances within the communication between coaches and players and extracurricular roles within the team. So please listen carefully, get your notepads out. It's a very fun podcast. We had a very natural flow to this conversation and I really enjoyed it. It was one of the better podcasts in terms of flow. So please listen in and let me know what you think. Subscribe to this channel if you haven't yet. Also subscribe to all the podcast platforms on all your audio platforms that you use on your phone. And yeah, I'm looking forward to welcoming you back on the next one. See you soon. And we are recording. Stefan, nice to see you. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, we were dabbling between whether we should do it in German or English, but we said, let's get this information out there. It needs to be out there, and let's do it in English. It's a bigger audience and a wider audience, and I'm sure this will be a very interesting podcast for a lot of up and coming player development coaches.
Well, I hope so. I hope to leave stuff here that can be used for whoever on whatever level. And yeah, happy to do it in English. I hope it's not too bad.
No, two semi Germans talking English. It was much weirder for me with the Lithuanian guest to talk in English, but it's for me it comes a lot more natural to talk English or German. So let's start a little bit about your background. I don't remember where we met, and I don't know, like it was probably some visit in Bamberg or maybe through Brendan Rooney. I don't remember honestly how we met, but after looking into your past a little bit and talking to you, and with all due respect to Austria, but Austria is not a basketball country, right? I mean, it's more soccer oriented, I would say, or winter sports oriented. How did you find yourself going into the sport of basketball?
Well, first, you're perfectly right. Austria is not a real basketball country. It's a winter sport country of top world level, but basketball is not a very big deal there, unfortunately. I think my family background made me play basketball from a very, very, very early age on. My advantage is talking about Austria, that my mom is from the Czech Republic, where basketball is much more important. So I grew up right at the border, Czech-Austrian border, and my dad was in basketball. My mom too. My brother played. So my parents were our coaches in on our youth teams. So the classic sports family or basketball family. And from age six, I started to go to practice on a regular basis, and that was it.
Sounds like it's very similar to my father was a player. My mother was a team handball player. I was going to my father's practices when I was like 4 or 5 years old. So it's in the shoes, and once it's in there, you can't get it out.
Can't get it out. I'm happy about it. It taught me so much, and I come from a small city north of Vienna, as I said, close to the Czech border, or right between Vienna and Brno. And Brno in the 70s and 80s was a very, very good place for basketball. So later on, these influences, let it be players or coaches, that came to our small town club, were a very, very important basketball influence for me. But in those early days, I mean, there was nothing better for me than just to be in the gym and watch some older youth categories play, or watch my brother's team play, or have games with my team. And it's still a small town in a non-basketball country, but basketball is still important there. So they have their mini basketball bubble there. And now my brother runs the whole club, and it's still a not a bad place, not a bad basketball place, to say it like that.
Yeah, Czech Republic in general is it's not a bad basketball place. I mean, it's
definitely not.
Yeah. So there also you were playing at a high level. So eventually, before you were playing professionally, you were also at Hawaii Pacific for 1 year.
For 1 year, yes.
For 1 year. So, like, explain yourself. Hawaii. Why did you leave Hawaii after 1 year?
Well, first, it was so hard to get there because we're talking about Austria. We're talking about the mid 90s, where there was still no internet, or at least not much. No videos, no YouTube. It was hard to communicate, one of the assistants of Hawaii Pacific had played in Austria before, so he came to Vienna and he saw me play, and that's basically how it started. And then we just talked through the telephone, the classic communication, through the time difference. Usually it was night when the coach from Hawaii called and asked me if I was interested, and of course I was. And that's how I came to Hawaii. I felt I'm on a different planet. That's how far it felt. And why did I leave after 1 year? I think it was a great experience for me. I was I was already 21, I think 20 or 21 that time. Late bloomer, very, very, let's say, protected. Thanks to my parents, but it was time for me to leave home. So I grew up late, but I did grow up when I left for Hawaii, because it was so far away, and I knew I wouldn't come back home for a year. And so that life experience was the biggest learning process for me. The basketball was a lot different. Obviously, I had played on the Austrian national team already, and college basketball is something totally different. I learned a lot. At the same time, I thought after this year, I would probably not become an NBA player. I would not see myself or my basketball future in the States. So you said I played on a very high level. I would say I was a higher level player, Euro Cup back then, Supporter Cup, and that's what I went back to. So there was one Austrian team, St. Pölten, back then that played very, very solid basketball. And after this year, they made me an offer to play for them, and I thought, okay, that might be a realistic future to become a good player in Europe, and that's why I did not go back to Hawaii. But it was a hard decision.
I can imagine. I mean, it was probably more realistic and rational choice, and not an emotional choice. It was more like the self-reflective and very self-aware choice to go back and to start your professional career. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, definitely. At the same time, I was enrolled at the Pedagogical Institute in Vienna, so I was able to get my degree there and play professionally already. So the classic European combination back then, you know, basketball players would practice once, twice a day, but also be able, just from the time schedule, to go to university. So I felt, okay, now's the time to do that. Play Euro Cup, finish my degree. So I became a teacher for English and physical education. And yeah, as you said, it was a relatively rational decision, basketball decision, a realistic one. I thought it was a good decision, but you never know, right?
you never know. The sliding doors moments, you just don't know what it would have been like. You know, like the choices you make, you will reflect later on as like, but you never want to think of what would have been. You know, I always think, I oftentimes think about it, but at the end of the day, the fact is I'm happy where I'm at. It's not like that things could have been like differently. I was thinking one time what would have been, because I went to a soccer tryout when I was like, I want to say 11, 10-ish, 11-ish, something like that. And I killed. I destroyed the soccer practice tryout with regular shoes on grass. I scored like 3 goals. The coach came up to me afterwards and is like, "Man, you and this other Bosnian kid, we're gonna provide you with shoes, with training gear, with everything." And I was in seventh heaven. I was like, "Man, this is phenomenal. I'm about to be a superstar." And then I come home and I'm I tell my father, "Is like, look, the coach wants to have me. I'm playing basketball at the same time, and let me do soccer." He's like, "No, you have to stick with one. You have to decide one. And whether it's right or wrong, that's debatable, which we can get into also, and how much variety in your coming up you should have." I just stuck with basketball. I didn't go back to soccer. I always kept playing as a hobby, and I was good. But then I was thinking, like, what would have been, because in Germany, the investment in soccer is through the roof, right? Like the youth development, the gear you get, everything is just geared towards getting the best players to come up. So I wonder sometimes what would have been, but I definitely would not be here right now. So
we all do, right? We all do, and it's just natural. I think the best skill is to love what you do, like to decide, to think well about it, and then decide rationally and emotionally, and then stick with it and be happy
yeah,
about it.
Exactly. Yeah. So let's go a little bit into the choice of being a player development coach, because you played, you had injuries, you had a big back injury, as I remember, and you decided to go specifically into player development. What was the choice? Because in the around 2006-ish, 7-ish, 8-ish, something like that? Is that about the time frame where you were?
Yeah.
So, and you decided to go that route specifically, where player development was not really a word that framed in the basketball context in Europe specifically. So what made you decide to go into this niche and then be confident enough that you can have a career in that, because neither the budgets nor the mentality is made out for that in Europe until today. Actually, it's very restrained. So explain yourself, Stefan.
That's a great question, because I think I had never planned to become a coach. Actually, the other way around, I wanted to be a player like so hard. I think I was one of these guys trying too hard a little bit. You mentioned the injuries, so I always thought, yeah, I'm gonna come back quicker and come back earlier, and it didn't help me. But back then, also athletic training was totally different. I was a relatively skilled and skinny type of body, where back then you looked at the guys, okay, you're 6'5", you need to have an 190 pounds or 90 kilos at least. Nobody looked at how you are built. So I think that hurt me a little bit, because I was trying so hard, and I was trying to lift hard and gain weight and come back early after injuries. But then at age 30, there was, I just felt it. And again, I didn't plan to become a coach at all. I saw myself to play at least till 35 or even longer. That's how bad I wanted it. But my body gave such clear messages that I had to quit. So there was that degree that I had for teaching. And somehow in Nuremberg, where I had played at last, they asked me if I wanted to be an assistant coach. And I thought, why not for a year? Like, they had zero budget, nothing. So I combined it with going back to my home country, back to Austria, and the St. Pölten club, who had been the club that I had my best years at. And they had opened basically a youth academy like thing, and they wanted to give me a job there. So I worked there from Mondays to Thursdays in Austria, and then hopped on the train every Thursday back to Nuremberg to be an assistant for the Nuremberg first division team. They didn't have any money, so at least in the second year they paid my train ticket. So I thought, that's what I want to do. Why not be an assistant coach in the German Bundesliga for a year? And to answer your question, why player development? It wasn't a decision that I made, okay, I'm going to do development now. It was just my biggest passion. Already as a player, when somebody taught me something, it just meant everything to me. That's just how I function. I think I'm a chronic learner. I have a totally growth mindset. I don't know if you read the book, the mindset book from Carol Dweck. That's how I, like, I'm 99.9% growth mindset. It bores me to be in a fixed mindset. It bores me to think I am who I am and I will not be able to change anymore. So that teaching part, especially in basketball, it was just so interesting for me. I just loved it to work on a new move or to improve myself. And to this day, I love practice more than games. I mean, I love games, but I love practice more. So in those practices, when I just started from one day to the other to be an assistant, I felt that's how I function. That's how my brain and my thinking works. I would just look at these guys and think, well, I think he could do this better, and why not teach this guy that? To the contrary of these, let's say, these technical assistant coaches or coaches who see the whole picture, who see tactics very easily, who understand, okay, these guys are running this play. I'm not that good at that. Like, I have to look at a play 2-3 times to memorize it completely. You know, I mix up, oh, did the 3 start in the right corner or the left corner? Was it the 4 or the 5? At the same time, I would naturally see fingers, feet, knees, angles, biomechanical movement. It comes easy for me. I just love it. I love to observe. I like to see or watch people. How do they move? What are they good at? How are their hands? And it comes easy to me, and I have a huge interest in it. So it that connects me with all those thoughts I have, and they are never ending. What if I teach this guy that? Oh, he can't go right. What if I do this? So it's just so. I just love it. So it became the direction that I went to, but it was not planned at all.
Okay, so you had a Terminator vision already, that you automatically identified the things that stood out to you, and the red dot in your eye identified the problems. But was that the case when you were a player as well, or is that something that when you changed the lines, or like from inside the lines, outside the lines, is that something that when it started to really point out?
I think also as a player, I thought like that much. Like I was, it didn't make so much of a difference to me. Are we running a zipper offense or is it a diamond action? Everything gives something. But how are we going to solve it? Okay, to the right, to the left, step back. Also on the defensive end, what can my guy do? Like, what is that? Where is he good at? So how to use the body, how to optimize my movement, how to learn something new, that's how I function. And I think also as a player, that was the thing that drove me, like, learn something new. I remember I had a talk with one coach who was about to become the new coach of that team that I was in. He told me, well, you're 26 now. I think, so he was kind of telling me, that's it. Like, you are who you are, and there's not going to – and it was depressing for me. Like, I don't want to play for you. Like, you see me, that's it, and I can't learn. Like, yeah, and yeah. It is a question that is, like, totally legitimate and everything. And everybody asks himself that, what is the age – until what age can we learn? And again, I don't want to accept any borders in this. I think we can learn forever. To what percentage? I don't know. But how boring does it have to be to think like that? You are this, you are that, you are that, and we're going to stay like that forever for the rest of our lives. That's not a thinking that I want to accept.
I'm completely with you on that. It's depressing. It's depressing, like you said, and it makes me feel like I'm wasting my time on this earth as well. Like, what am I doing here if I'm already who I am? And people said, I'm not going to change for like, I didn't change. I'm not going to change. If you don't change, then it's bad. We're supposed to change. We're supposed to change. We're supposed to keep our values intact. We're supposed to keep our ethical barometer or ethical compass, as they say, in the right direction. But we're supposed to develop. We're not supposed. That's why our humankind developed over centuries, whatever. But naturally, I'm the same as well. Where you feel like, okay, now I understood this. I need to know now something else. I need to continue to add something else, like a Lego house. Like it's one Lego after another, and at the end of the day, hopefully, I have a nice little castle built inside my head or my life, you know, in general. So that's something that I will never stop either.
Definitely.
I read a quote that you said, bewusst unsichtbar. So translatable would be consciously invisible. On the coaching staff, you're consciously trying to stay invisible. Why? Explain yourself again, Stefan, please.
Well, I think it's relatively easy for me to understand what not to do. Let's look at it like that. So, if I was a player and I just turned the perspective around, if I was a player and I had a skills coach that teaches me something and then puts himself into the spotlight about it, I don't think I would like it that much. So, and that's already it. That's already it. I think there's many players that had great success in improving, and I was a factor in helping them, but they improved. They improved themselves. They put the work in. Of course I helped, but they did it. If it was about me, I would be able to do it with everybody, but that's not possible. I can't. You know, there's guys where I try to improve, or I try to help them, but it doesn't work that well. I'm just trying to avoid things that the players would dislike, because I wouldn't like that. You know, yeah. I improved my shot. Thanks, coach. That's your job. You know, just be happy about it. And we all know in these days, it's also not the best just to hide. But there's this saying, do good things and talk about them. Yeah, once in a while. But I think if you do good things, and if you work well, and if you help players, good things gonna happen. You don't have to talk about it all the time. You don't have to be in the spotlight. And I like that background position a lot. I love it. It has developed through the years. Also here in Bamberg with the Fleming staff, I used to be a normal assistant coach, doing a lot of player development, just as Arne Voigtman, the other assistant, and Chris Fleming too. Like, we all did a lot of player development. I was in the front line, let's say it like that. After getting fired, maybe that has something to do with that. I liked my new position with the following staff of Andrea Trinchieri. The staff was bigger. We were five coaches instead of three. I did only player development, or almost exclusively player development. And I liked that background position a lot more. Maybe it was a little bit of staying in a more secure spot, mm-hmm. you know, or not wanting it anymore after six crazy years in Bamberg. But I liked, and I still love it, that position of, okay, I'm helping these guys when nobody's watching. So through the week, we're working on these things. Everybody's gone, and we are improving, and we are working and talking and working on something together with the player. And then in the game, it works. I know it. He knows it. But I think that's it. And there doesn't have to be more.
Yeah. Also, like, it's a specific role. It helps you also focus specifically on one thing, and you can really thrive in one, that one position and that one role. And it, essentially, it's also about not having a need to feed the ego to have the attention. Like you said, also people will talk. Word of mouth is probably way more important than any kind of social media post that people do. It's more about what people say about you, not what the public thinks about you.
I think the players, they transport your reputation.
Yeah.
And they are the most, or also the colleague coaches.
Yep.
And that's the most important thing. I don't want to be that guy who says, wow, social media, it's all bad. I think everybody can post what he wants. Why not?
Yeah.
I do it too, to a certain extent. And I don't want to close myself to modern tendencies or something. But for me, that's just my value. There has to be a certain limit. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Let's get technical a little bit. I want to talk about a little bit about nuances, and let's go dive into the profession a little bit. Mm-hmm. I'm a player on a team. You have a player that you're working with on a team from prior years. You're coming to visit and you see I'm doing something wrong. How do you approach me? Why should I trust you with something that you may or may not tell me, being an outsider coming in with a let's say a player who's well respected.
So you are on the team that on the Bamberg team, let's say.
Yeah, hypothetically, yes.
Well, usually, and I really try to keep it simple for me and the player. Like the situation usually determines 80% of what we're gonna do. So first is what time of the year is it? Is it June? The player already comes in. And there's a lot of time. There's no head coach in the gym, maybe. So how is the whole organizational frame? And the differences can be huge in this. Okay, so why should you trust me? We'll connect. We will connect. So again, I'm a good observer. I don't rush it. So I usually find time to look at the guy, and I'm prepared. Obviously, before somebody comes in, I watch him on video, I get some information, and then we connect. And everybody's different. Some come in and they tell you everything about themselves on the first day. And some start talking in late October. To answer the question, why should you trust me? I don't know, but usually they trust me. I take everybody serious. I really enjoy talking to people. I really enjoy asking questions and finding out who they are. I have a natural interest in connecting. I just 99% of the people I meet, I like, you know, I like to listen to them and I like to observe them as basketball players. And then it's on me to find the right time. And sometimes patience is the best thing. I remember Nikos Tzitzis, who came in here already as a European basketball icon. And who am I to go into the first practice and tell him, listen, man, we have to work on this or that. Of course, I didn't do anything, not anything. And it came naturally after, I don't know, 6 or 7 weeks. I remember Nikos approached me and said he wanted to work on this and that, like on two topics. If I had, and of course I had time, and of course I loved it, and it became a great connection, a great relation of athlete coach, also from the human side. We had great workouts and great talks, but it needed time. I remember Andrea back then was pushing a little bit. I think you should work. And I always said, well, no, let's wait. Let him come, because we have a guy who had the best coaches in the world, or some of them. And the situation just had to develop. And maybe with a younger player, let's say we recruit our under 16 guy, of course, my approach would be different, more dominant, more active. And so every player is different. Every situation is different. But of course, the connection has to be there before we go any further.
Yeah, again, going back to your self-awareness where you left Hawaii to not to pursue a career in America, but this also shows or things that come to mind. That thing that comes to mind here is self-awareness of knowing there's a time and place to approach this player, there's a time and place to approach that player, and dealing with extreme pessimism or hesitation, you have to have some sort of self-awareness. You have to understand, okay, and having a feel for people as well to understand, okay, now is not the time to talk. Now I rather let it slide or let it go. Maybe I'll wait for him to approach. I'll be an observer for the time being, and then when the time comes, either he's going to ask me for something, for some help, and I'll be prepared to help, or I anticipate and I see that there's a need, extreme need for help in that regard, and you cannot help but hold, but you cannot hold back. You cannot help but tell him, and then it's a certain kind of delicate situation or delicate word of choices, choice of words that you use to approach and not to step over the line. If you don't
mind. Definitely. I mean, it sounds so simple, but there's such a huge importance. And I come back to Chris Fleming, who back then when I was working for him, I thought, well, it's about drills and knowledge and exercises. And he always mentioned, I like how you connect with people. And I'm like, oh yeah, connect with people. And that's 10 years ago. And now a couple of years later, I understand much more how important it is. So I can approach a player and say, listen, what are you doing here? Like that shot is, well, some things are not bad, but that elbow is so far out. We have to fix it. Or I say, yeah, the rhythm of your shooting is really good. Really good. I think if we look at the elbow a little bit, it might become even better. So we're talking about the same topic from totally different directions. Mm-hmm. That is my daily business. And again, it comes so easy for me when I just change the perspective. If I'm a player and that coach comes in on day one, two, or three and says, ha, here's something bad. Let me explain you. How will I react? Of course not open. Yeah. And of course not positive. The other way around, wow. He thinks the rhythm of my shooting is good. And probably some coaches already told me about my elbow, and he doesn't see it as a big problem, but maybe he's going to help me with it. And that opens so many doors, and it's so easy. It's like teaching don'ts or do's, right? Mm-hmm. Let's not underestimate the opponent. Oh, there it is already, underestimate. Or hey, let's play really hard against them because they're good. So it's so easy, and we all know it, but I think it requires a certain discipline in our language and in the choice of our words to do it well.
Yeah, again, it's the nuances of the choice of words is very important in that regard. All right, Stefan, I'm starting to trust you. I'm letting you into my circle of trust. There, you crossed the threshold there. I'm in a slump, and I'm a shooter. I was a shooter. Help me to get out of it. Where do we start? What's the approach to eliminating a slump?
Great question. Now, first is our connection again. I want you to feel that I'm your coach when you shoot well, but I'm also your coach when you don't shoot it well. I am there, and I'm going to be there when you have not played. You come back from a road trip and you had a DNP. I'm going to be there, and we're going to do something. I'm not going to offer you magical actions that make you a good shooter again, but I'll be there and we'll do it. We'll have some video prepared that might help you. We'll talk. We'll spend time. We'll have time together, and I'll keep believing in you. That's because I believe in improvement. I believe in growth. At the same time, accepting, and then I come with numbers. I'm not very good with numbers, but usually it helps to tell a basketball player, listen, basketball functions in a way that usually you miss more shots than you make. Like usually, you know, maybe not a big man.
Shooting less than 50%. I mean, that's...
Exactly. that's just, you know, that's just how it is. And sorry, Mr. Player so-and-so, I wish you would, but maybe you're not going to change it. Maybe most probably that rule is for you too. So we can talk about misses all the time, like for the next 2 weeks, or turn it around and look at it like this. You were 1 for 8 and 2 for 9, but let's look at the makes. And again, here's my choice of words. Here's my choice of perspective.
Positive reinforcement.
Of course. But then again, I must look at the player and analyze a little bit. Has he worked a lot? Has he worked on it recently or not? And then I also have to give him some tough love maybe and say, look, I think you can improve, but it wasn't enough these last 2 weeks. I didn't see you come in and work on that shot at all or not enough. Don't get me wrong. I'm here, but you're never here. So there's the shooting slump. Okay, but come tomorrow, 30 minutes earlier, and we'll work on it. And then again and again and again. And you will see the work, the trust in you, my trust in you, and you also your trust in our work, and the patience. So these three things, the work, the trust, and the patience. It can be 3 days or 3 weeks. It has to be 3 months, 3 years, right? Mm-hmm. Where you work on it constantly. I like to compare the skill work with the physical work. You know, everybody understands we have to work on the body every day, prepare the body for practice. The skill is the same way. We are not good shooters forever. You know, we just like strengthening the body, stretching the body, we have to work on these skills too. They go away if we don't touch them on a regular basis.
Have you noticed over the years, like the most common problem shooters have? Is there something like a common denominator across the shooters that you've had in your career?
No. For some it's a technical part. For some it's a mental, more of a mental part. Everybody functions differently. Some have a big drive. Anton Gavel was like that. Like he had a big natural drive to prove everybody wrong. That's where he was coming from. And we had a very tough love for each other. Like he hated it to miss, and he was blaming me to give him the wrong hints, and then I gave him bad words back, and so that was still the first steps in my career, if it is one. And we have the same language, like Czech and Slovakian is very, very similar. So that was a very emotional connection. He, for example, he had this almost negative drive. So he was taking his energy from a negative side, but it was a huge energy. Yeah. And as long as it didn't cross a certain border, it was good for him because he needed that thought of I'm outworking everybody here and I'm proving everybody wrong. The whole world says I can't shoot, but I'm gonna show you guys. And he came with that energy, and I just had to lead him because he had such a big motor. Mm-hmm. But little, like not much skill, but that huge motor and the big heart, and that's what made him at the end a 40+% 3-point shooter in the EuroLeague.
Sometimes you have to funnel that energy, and for a player by himself, it's difficult to understand how to funnel that information, that emotion, and that energy into the right direction. Because I always relate to me playing. I was even lower level player, but I was playing passionately, emotionally, and then those emotions sometimes get in your way. But once you learn how to direct that emotion, whether it's like, let's direct that emotion on the defensive end. If I'm not making shots, I'm going to commit myself fully, emotionally, physically, passionately on a defensive end. I will be physical. I will feel my body better when I'm physical. I will feel every little blood vessel in my fingertips by diving on the floor, by taking charges, by getting the energy, the blood flowing. And then I will start making shots eventually because I feel more confident from that point, from the defensive point of view. And then I feel more confidence and strength on the offense. That's how usually, like you said, every player functions differently. But I also saw that as a strength of mine to to, all right, I'm going to regroup myself on a defensive end, and then my offense will come into place. Have you experienced that as well?
Well, definitely. There's these players who are so talented, but sometimes can't find the door into the game. They feel like they're just running up and down. And maybe Brian Roberts was like that a little bit, you know, biggest shot maker, maybe, or important shot maker in Bamberg,
yeah, Bamberg
history. And at some points, there was frustration because we felt like he wasn't a part of the game. And for these players, I'm not saying for him specifically, but many times these very talented guys, they could do so much and you're waiting for them. Like, when are you taking over? Because you could do so much.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you said, it can be a very good help for these guys. Well, get yourself into the game with something easy. Get a good rebound.
Yeah.
Touch somebody. Give somebody high five. Stop somebody and be happy about it. And that opens the door to the game. Take a shot. Take an easy shot, a quick layup, make a good pass, stuff like that. And definitely. But everybody's different.
Let's talk about nail length, because shooters also have a little bit issues when their nails are a little bit long. And I've read a little quote that talks about nail length. So how important is the nail length for not necessarily shooters, but for players in general? Because I've experienced that as well when I had them too short or too long. And there's a difference. Sometimes I was more comfortable when they're rather long than short.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was always important to me to have the perfect feel at the very ends of my fingertips, because the ball is still controlled by my fingertips till the very end. And I think there's another, I don't know, half inch or half centimeter. Mm-hmm. Where I can use my release line a little more. I remember one time with the Nets when I looked at Caris LeVert's nails. So they became a topic, and his were not cut very well, and some were a lot longer than the others. And I wanted to just create an awareness in his head for, look, the hand is the part of the body that shoots the ball into the basket or just gets it in the air. Like the part of your body that has the ball in the last moment is your hands, is your fingertips. But when your nails are this long, like you, that part's not going to be there because you'll be already scratching the ball.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he still does it, but I remember it was around Christmas and I gave him a little Christmas gift, like a nail clipper and for that. And the good thing is, the good thing was that while we were talking and joking about it a little bit, Joe Harris was next to it. I'm like, Joe, can we please look at your fingers? And his looked perfectly cut. So I was lucky in that situation to have Joe Harris right next to us, and he showed his hands. And as you see, that's shooter's nails. That's how it is. So is it are the nails 90% secret, or I don't know, determining the percentage of your shooting? Definitely not. Definitely not. But to me, that everything is important, and also the nails are important. Yeah.
That's definitely, I've experienced, that's why I thought of it. And when I read it, I was like, okay, this is something that I want to touch on as well. I remember like mine having to be slightly there, like it has to be slightly there for me just to feel at the end.
Yes.
But it, like, the length matters definitely.
Definitely.
Kyle Hines. So mm-hmm. What, Kyle Hines, have you listened to the podcast?
Parts of it. Yes.
Okay. I'm put you on the spot there. Sorry, but he mentioned the parkour that you made for him, throwing stuff in the way for him to avoid certain obstacles on the ground when he was rolling to the basket or driving to the basket. Can you walk through that a little bit of what your idea behind that is?
There we go. There's so many things that I used to do back then, and when I look at it now, I have the feeling that I didn't know anything. And I feel that I know so much more. And what I do now is so much different than back then. The game has changed. The skills have changed. My methods have changed. To be honest, I don't remember that well what we used to do back then. If I look at it now, I'm like, man, if Kyle was 10 years younger, I could teach him so much more. because I think the organizational frame has changed. We invented pre-practices on a daily basis we just started to do it and copied it a little bit from the Spurs system or from the NBA system back then. Maybe we have time to talk about that later. So looking at it now, I feel like, oh man, it was maybe 20% of what I could give him now. But I'm happy you mentioned it. To be honest, I didn't listen to that part. But the good thing, or the fantastic thing about Kyle is he was just back then already such an impressive personality. He was treating everybody in this whole city so well, and he had this aura about him, this unbreakable positivity and strength. And obviously, I'm not the first.
Yeah,
we all know it, and that's what makes him so special. And in retrospective, I think I got so much more out of it than he got out of me, because to work with somebody like him and give him something on his way, I mean that just makes myself so happy. And to still be connected and text once or twice a year, that's just great.
Kyle is professional. I mean, there's a different league. I mean, we're talking about a different league of a person. But talking about also in terms of professionalism and attention span that, you know, like we all know that Kyle has. But have you felt over the years a dip in attention span a little bit of information that can be absorbed by a player, of how much? Because there's an overflow of information, not only on the basketball floor, which has to be funneled by the coaches as well. They have to deal with attention and information from the outside. So have you noticed when you're talking and coaching players in terms of like their dip in attention and remembering certain things that you tell them?
Oh, definitely. There's these guys who want to know everything, and they know everything. Coming back to Anton Gavel, he was like that. John Goldsberry was like that. Nikos Tzitzis, of course. These totally endlessly committed people who live basketball, who live sports. They are in a niche. I'm not saying people who are not in this niche cannot be successful, but that one niche, these totally committed basketball people, they know scores of the whole league. They know scores of every European league. Mm-hmm. They watch second division Italy. Once they go home, they take the newspaper and they start it on the backside because they want to see sports results. And that's also the group of players. They want the total scouting report. They want they want to know all the plays. And they have these concentration level that is a different one. And then there's other guys. Now we're already talking about, or we're moving in a direction. How do brains work, right? So I would say these guys are a little bit left brain dominant. They're analytical thinkers. They can concentrate very long and very well. They can listen. But they're not the super talented people who find solutions on the court that you have not or hardly worked on. Now we're coming back in contrary to that, to right brainers who are super creative, who cannot digest so much and they don't want it. They cannot concentrate for so long. Now we're talking about the Brian Roberts or Darius Miller players. You know, they do things intuitively, and they...
Teodosic comes to mind for me.
Oh, definitely. I've never coached him, so I don't know. But if you look at him, most probably. You know, you give him the ball for the last offense, you draw up a play, and the defense changes something, and they find a totally different solution just by being creative and open. Where the left brainer maybe... Well, we wanted to enter the ball to the right, but he's denied. What now? So everybody has his advantages, right? The totally reliable left brainer who can concentrate very, very long.
Yeah.
Or the super creative right brainer who maybe needs the ball when we need a basket. Let's give the ball to him. He's going to do something.
Yep. So do you do also video work with guys remotely? So tell me of, we'll get into the time management and handling two jobs, two different jobs or multiple players at the same time in around the world. But how many video sessions do you see necessary with one player to do with one player in a week? Like what's the frequency of necessity? Because it's probably also, it varies probably from player to player. But in regards to like feeding him information, how often do you see it necessary?
Again, it varies a lot. I see the borderline for me when it becomes watching TV.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody likes and needs to see himself. I think there's a need. And some want it every day. Some want the all their touches from the last game where... Looking at it from a technological side, it has become so much easier now with Synergy or Instat or all these platforms. 10 years ago, it was so much harder just to produce clips for somebody. So here's your 10 shots of the last game. So it's definitely a lot easier for me just from the time frame to stay connected with, let's say, Thomas Satoransky or with whoever in the world. And send him some video feedback after working with him in the summer. So very hard to answer this question. I think the players that are on the Bamberg team, for example, that I work with every day, they need it. And usually I give them individual clips after the game. Hey, here's that good glide and 3-point shot that we worked on. Sometimes it's 3, sometimes it's 5, sometimes it's not none. And sometimes they come, like Brad Wanamaker was like that. He just wanted, after every game, he wanted to look at his touches quickly on the iPad. There we are again, technology. I have the iPad on the on practice, and we go on Synergy quickly, and there it is. You know, that's much easier. That's so much easier.
Yeah.
I would not consider myself a technological expert at all. I think I understand that it has to be there, and I'm taking advantage of it. And I also want, I'm also improving or trying to improve and stay on it. But at the same time, if I have the feeling, okay, here's a 17-year-old kid telling me, can you send me clips? I'm exaggerating now a little bit. Well, I think we should start on the court and then look at it. I have my phone in my pocket a lot. So usually if the situation allows it, for example, with the Czech Republic Academy that has just started this fall, we do that. Like I record their shooting, and if it's only 5 shots, that's already something. After practice, we hook it on a screen, and the kid can see, oh wow, that's my shot, that's me.
Mm-hmm.
Like the own perspective is a totally different one, the inner one and the outer one. So I do use that a lot, but it should not become a watching TV thing.
Yeah, that's one thing. When you see yourself doing something, it's always a bit weird at first. You know, like you have to get used to also seeing yourself. I have to get used to hearing yourself talk. I also hated my voice when I started hearing myself talk. I mean,
everybody does. Yes.
Yeah, it's very weird. But this, I can imagine it's the same thing also with shooting. When you show players, it show yourself. I never was fortunate enough to have a development coach who worked with me on that, and to analyze your own movements. And you know, see the biomechanics, seeing yourself move, of which direction to go, what angle to take. I think those things are very important and very they get underestimated until you do them by players.
Yes, the inner vision of a player might differ so much. You might tell him, listen, take the ball up. Your ball is too low, and his feel is that the ball is super high.
Yeah,
and then nothing helps better than video. And it's so easy. Again, I can take the phone only, record him and show him. And then it's going to be like, oh, wow, I thought it's much higher.
What do you record? You record from the front or from the back? From the side?
I like two perspectives, like from the side or the front. That's usually enough for me.
Shooting hand side or other side?
Shooting hand side mostly. So that's what I want, or that's what helps me. And then I add the back and the other side. That's usually enough, just to get a good vision. If there's a point where that needs to be looked at more, obviously I can change my perspective. It's not a big deal. You know, we're talking about just taking three or four steps to the side and looking at it from a diagonal angle. So, I mean, there's not much technology hidden behind that.
So let's talk about video work remotely and in terms of like the experience you had with the Brooklyn since 2018. Can you like explain again, explain yourself, how was the experience of working for two teams across two continents at the same time? And how did you manage the time as well as the players across both teams? Because you had to invest yourself in both equally well in order to be effective and feel that for the player to feel that you care about him, because it cannot be just, you know, spontaneously here and there, because then they lose trust in you. So I think it's very hard to imagine doing that, but obviously it worked for you and it worked well. And it's I'm just curious about the management, time management and the investment in it.
Yeah. Well, I think that situation came up by talking about it. I was on a contract here in Bamberg, and there was talk. First, I had some trips to the NBA that totally surprised me. I was not expecting such a big passion for player development over there, and such a big value in this job. So that's what totally thrilled me, and where I started to think outside of the box a little bit. My family's here. I didn't feel like moving them. And also my contract here was valid, and I still am very committed to the Bamberg club. But then I started talking to some teams, and Sean Marks just had the openness to think out of the box a little bit. And it was a fantastic setup where, okay, the NBA has the interest and also the financial background to do something like that. So how to manage the time, it was relatively easy, because we would find windows of about 4 days. That's an important time frame for me. Through the years, I felt like these 4 days with a player is like a time frame where you can do a lot. After that, it becomes too much a little bit, fingers, feet, elbows. Before that, only two or three might not be enough. But I feel after all these years that in 4 days, I can do a lot. So that's what we started to look at. It concretely, it looked like I would leave Bamberg when, let's say, the Bamberg team was on the road. They wouldn't need me much, because there's games, there's shoot-arounds and flights or trips. So they would leave town or have a day off and then a road game. So I would go to Brooklyn. A lot of organization obviously involved. Are the Nets in town or on the road? If we decided let's choose these days, I would leave from Frankfurt in the morning and be in New York at 11. And then go directly to the practice facility and be ready to do some work again. And then two, three more days. And on the last day, right after practice, let's say 4 or 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening or in the afternoon, I would fly out of New York after practice through the night, land in Frankfurt at 7 in the morning, and go right to the Bamberg practice facility. Let's say the NBA travel comfort allows that. Maybe not a European lower level comfort would allow that, but obviously having a good plane ticket and somebody to pick me up from the airport made all that possible. And maybe above all, it was pre-COVID. So unfortunately, my second season with the Nets from March on, I couldn't fly anymore. You know, all these restrictions made it so much more complicated. And unfortunately, I couldn't finish my second season with the Nets. And then everything changed quickly. How we know it can happen. Players left, new coaching staff. Kenny Atkinson left, and but still, it was a fantastic challenge for me to have this little time to prepare, to be prepared for 6, 7, 8 players, and then wait and see what door or what window would open. Okay, you have 15 minutes with Caris LeVert now, but not too intense because, you know, there's a game tomorrow. Here's Nick Claxton. You have 25 minutes, and then you're going to have him tomorrow again. But then there's going to be a change again. No, he's not in tomorrow, but maybe on your third day. So I would be in a constant position of, okay, waiting what window would open. At the same time, I was trying to be well prepared for all of the windows that might open.
But the coach assigned you the players, the coach, like, I'm just trying to imagine you coming in and then you're just like, you're getting assigned and introduced to the player as a new coach.
Of course. I mean, the very first trip to the Nets was back then, I think it was end of May or June, basically a total week of observing, getting, you know, looking at the players, getting to know all the coaches, stuff like that. Of course. I mean, I had one trip to Brooklyn every 4 to 6 weeks. So there was a lot of trips. And then once the season started, in the first year, it was Chris Fleming. In the second year, it was Jacques Vaughn, who would be my, let's say, point man, who would organize the trips, who would know, okay, I'm coming in. Let's maybe think about one or two workouts with this guy or that guy. And in between, back in Bamberg, obviously, I would stay connected with video, send voiceover video with the players' shots, and send them to the responsible coach. That was a very important thing.
There you go.
That I don't come in as, okay, I'm the king of skills here. Everybody else, move away. So that is a situation that I was very aware of. That's very delicate.
It's very delicate. Exactly. I was going to say that there has to be a certain, like, a triangle of trust between the responsible coach, the player, and you.
Of course. But it's not easy if you are responsible of a player and then somebody else comes in and says, well, let's do that. So my favorite situations were when we were on the court together, the player, the responsible coach, and myself. Let's say here's Janan Musa. Here's Thiago Splitter and myself, or here's Pablo Prigioni with one of his players, or here's Jacques Vaughn with Caris LeVert and me, and we do it together. And so everything's open. So I'm trying to help the player and maybe even giving some things to the coach that he might be able to use to help his guy.
Yeah.
So that, I love that. That was a great dynamic, energetic situation, at the same time delicate, where you had to be aware, but it was super energetic, and I really loved it.
I love that's the one thing I love about, like, being on a team in a team environment, all these dynamics with the interpersonal interactions where you feel each other out and you feel the situation to keep it in control, you know, because you, like, it's also like being a shepherd, you know, almost like you're trying to keep the sheeps in the same parameters and not to get for the communication to get out of hand, and to make sure that the person, both people in that example, both people interpret you the right way, you know. So again, the choice of words, where you're coming from, the intent is good, that you're really trying to cooperate between the three of you and finding the right solution. I love this part of communication.
Yes. At the same time, I know where I'm coming from. So we're coming back to Austria. So here's the NBA. Here's the Brooklyn Nets.
Yeah.
Here's all-star basketball players or really good basketball. Here's his coaches who used to be former players who have won championships as players. And here's me telling, hey, let's work on his shot. So that is super delicate. And I was very, very aware of it. Again, these triangle situations were super dynamic and also productive. And I think I learned a lot through it.
Again, self-awareness. I mean, again, it comes down. I see that from our conversation. It comes up over and over. It's just the humbled self-awareness that you have that helps you also to be successful.
Yeah, humbleness, yes. But at the same time, being confident enough and saying, well, and that's also a thing that's different in the NBA, at least that's how I feel, to over here. Like really stepping into a situation and starting to change or improve or both. We do that over here. You know, the position of coaches are a little different. In the NBA, it's delicate. You know, players have a lot of power, have big egos, not in a bad way, but they are big and important personalities.
Yeah.
So that is a totally different approach. And
where does the confidence come from? Like, where is that originate from? Is that just from the experience that you had over and over with players that you feel confident in expressing and teaching your
skills? Yes. I know, let's say there's a lot of knowledge that I have in my head. Let's not only experience of teaching what I teach, but being a sports teacher, being a basketball coach, listening, reading books about or understanding biomechanics, that's like a very broad background, learning science about how we move, how we learn to move, understanding also scientific approaches. That's important. I remember Kenny Atkinson wanting me to, in one summer, to present a whole approach to shooting, how we look at shooting, also scientifically. And then how we're going to teach it? How do we? What is a good shot? What is the right shot? So that was his task for me, and I had to work on it, and then come to New York and present it. That was fantastic, a great chance for me to learn in that, and then step in front of the whole Brooklyn Nets coaching staff, and also stand my ground a little bit. So here's what I think. This is what I believe in. Here's what some of the best shooters in the world do. And that's what I think we could do methodologically on the court with this guy, with that guy. Here's how we can analyze. Here's the science behind it. That's all things that I know that I know them and they can help. Yeah. Are they the key to everything? No, but if a player asks me, why should I do that? Why should I place my feet on the ground and not be on the toes? Well, here's the biomechanical principle of force. Look at a weightlifter. Is he on his toes? Probably not. Like he's on his foot using his body in an optimal way. And I need to know that stuff. Like I need to be able to ask questions and not just say, well, I think it's the right way. Yeah, I have to know this is an optimal way for you, because I understand the levers of your body. Every shooter is different. Every shot is different. I know this is a step back shot. Your balance is totally different. And this is what's going to happen biomechanically, physically to your body. Every body, every shot is different, but biomechanics count for everyone. Like they are there and I have to understand them.
Yeah, that's why I also like the development of the right-handed step back to the right is somewhat of a miracle than the right-handed player having a step back to the left, because yes. Biomechanically it goes against not all laws of physics, but it's definitely more difficult. I mean, I just speaking from experience, but it's definitely more difficult to learn that.
It is, and here's another thing that gives me confidence. We talk about my confidence in these situations. If I teach skills and if I teach shooting, I need to be able to demonstrate them. Like I can't be a terrible shooter and then talking about the shot. So I have a lot of pride in being fit enough.
You can't be fat. Yeah. You can't be fat.
Maybe I should be fat, but I should be better be able to move around well. And of course I don't want to. And the way I'm built is not going to happen, but I need to be able to demonstrate shooting.
Yeah.
Now also, want to be able to demonstrate maybe a left-handed shot, at least a little bit,
yeah,
in a very solid way. or how we finish. If I show an extended crossover into a dribble one-step layup, I need and put my hand under the ball and bounce it to high, I need to be able to demonstrate that. And I take a lot of pride into that, and it also gives me confidence then to, hey, try this. Or, yeah. I don't know, Daniel Hackett, great worker, a lot of energy and working hard. And that's a guy where I'm like, or it used to be a guy when he was here, where we talked a lot about, okay, you have to work the right way. It's not only hard work. And if I look at posts these days, here we are with social media, hard work, all I read is hard work. Listen, that's not what's going to separate you from the others. There's a lot of people out there working hard.
Yeah.
But you have to work you have to work hard, don't get me wrong, but the right way too. Like, we can beat you up with 50 sticks and 25 pads, and you can throw up after the workout. Maybe it's not going to make you better.
Yep.
And I have a lot of confidence in doing things in a different way too, slowing things down and teaching, coming back to Hackett. Look, you don't have to be here for 40 minutes and kill yourself. It might give you a good conscience of, yeah, I worked hard, but let's do 25 minutes, but the right way. Your ball is too low. You're dipping it from your knees. Keep it higher. You will save almost a meter of carrying the ball. This stuff, I'm super interested in this stuff, in like working the right way. It's not about only repetitions. I understand there have to be repetitions, but there have to be attentive repetitions with a certain purpose, maybe with some reactions, with game-like awareness. Not only, okay, we shoot 1,000 shots every day. Yeah, on some days that's important. But if we take 1,000 bad shots, that's not going to give us – it's going to condition us, but that's about it.
Before we go into quick hitters, and I'm going to throw ATOs to finish the game here. I'm going to throw them at you. But one, like, crass – There's a German word that translates, that transcends between German and English, and English speaking people use crass as well, krass. Difference between NBA players and European players that you've noticed, or is it just in general players that may or may not have a bigger ego than maybe players in Europe, or ego in a sense of awareness of themselves, or is there something else that you've noticed that is intrinsically different in the NBA than in Europe?
I think the situations are different. The situations that you can work in with a player are different in the NBA than in Europe, especially once the season has started. In Europe, we can still do a lot more, right? We have more freedom, which is good and bad. The NBA has so much of monitoring, which is perfect. They measure fatigue. At the same time, when I don't know that the player is already in a bad state, I might work him out in Europe, 20 more minutes.
So data tracking.
Yes, data tracking. But players themselves as personalities, they are still who they are.
Yeah.
Some fit very well over there. Some fit better over here. Maybe Devin Hall. Who had a hard time, not a hard time, but who couldn't make it to an NBA team last season and is playing fantastically in the EuroLeague this year. Maybe because he's a little less athletic. I think he's athletic enough for the NBA, but not a great athlete for NBA level, but has this great basketball understanding, this awareness of 5-on-5 basketball on a smaller court that is so important over here in Europe. And he has that. And so he's just maybe a better fit for high level international or European basketball, but from the personality, he is who he is, you know.
You ready for the quick hitters?
Let's try it.
I'm drawing up ATOs here, buddy. First one, reflecting. Okay. What did you improve on the most as a coach over the course of your career? One thing.
Working on myself. Developing myself in all aspects.
One fact or detail about this profession in particular that nobody would ever think about being relevant?
You're going to work a lot. You're not going to make much money, and you're not going to be in the spotlight.
One thing besides the championships with the team that you are proud of?
All the great friendships, the great human connections that came with it to coaches and to players.
One personal skill or private skill apart from the game you wish you had?
Maybe a little bit more patience.
How can a player stop negative talk in his head?
Oh, great question. Work on it. Learn it. Learn it. Learn how to react. Learn positive gestures. Understand himself and learn to coach himself, like to coach the sport ego, coach himself. So here I am, Stefan, but there's Stefan, the basketball player. Learn to talk to yourself. Hey, stay calm. You're good. You're doing well. You just missed a shot. The next one's going in. It's as simple as that.
One daily habit that impacts your daily life as a coach?
Getting up in the morning and two steps out of my out of the door into my garden and having a little bit of yoga and some breathing exercises.
Best personal investment you've made?
Personal reading books, and I'm not a good reader. I'm a slow reader, but reading books about stuff that I'm not so good at.
Last one: what drives you every day to go to work?
Oh, being on the court with players, meeting people, being with them, talking, joking around, and doing something together.
Stefan, you've explained yourself very well today. You've passed you've passed with flying colors. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and it felt like really, as you said, you're very good with connecting with people, and I feel the same way. That's why obviously I'm doing a podcast, and I feel like I wouldn't be able to do it if I wouldn't be able to connect with people. But with you, it felt like a very natural flow of conversation in this podcast, and I really appreciate your time, and I hope to see you soon in person.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
All right. Bye, everybody. See you.
Bye-bye.